I mean, I've always believed that the most single useful thing any gay person can do is just to come out. As soon as you do that, then the world begins to change a bit because people realize, oh, gosh, there are lots of gay people, but people that I know, people, you know, my brother, my greengrocer, my lawyer, these are all gay people. I think that's all we can do. We can only testify in the end to who we are.
The actor Simon Callow reminding us of the importance of being true. We'll hear more stories like that one today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
Through that action of doing something brave, I felt brave. I think quite wrongly, you feel ashamed that you're not being your full self. I'm a really open person, but you do carry a shame with that. I think that's part of what, you know, societal homophobia does to us. I don't think you should blame the victims for that.
Legendary Australian actress and comedian Magda Szubanski discusses the difficulties of facing your true self when you're a staple of the screen. Plus,
I didn't write anything out. I didn't write anything down. I didn't tell anyone I was going to do it. But I think I just sort of knew somewhere I'm a writer, which means how many times am I ever going to get to be on television in front of tens or hundreds of millions of people?
The Oscar-winning screenwriter of The Imitation Game, Graham Moore, looks back at his extraordinary acceptance speech at last year's awards. And coming up soon.
When you first come out as gay, you probably feel what I felt 17 years ago. Overwhelming relief, coupled with a wonderful new batch of anxieties.
The writer Benjamin Law recalls the film that helped him get used to being here and being queer. We'll also revisit an icon of LA's club scene by way of a new documentary uncovering the story behind Jules' Catch One, and a word from Harvey Milk's nephew, Stuart. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Rylan. 2016 has shaped up to be an awfully strange year. American politics has given us an awful lot of divisive rhetoric, and it seems to be spreading at an alarming rate. For many young people, growing up in what often looks like a world of people quite unlike them, the world of movies can be one of the few places where freedom to be yourself really does exist. Films like Mean Girls or Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, can very easily take on a meaning far beyond the limitations of the screen and make us understand that it really does get better. Let's hear now from the Australian writer Benjamin Law, reading his essay about a film that taught him about the power of embracing your identity, even if you feel just a little bit queer.
When you first come out as gay, you probably feel what I felt 17 years ago. Overwhelming relief, coupled with a wonderful new batch of anxieties. How do people see me, you wonder, now that they know? And it's around this time that you start getting questions like, why do other gay people speak like that, and act like that, and dress like that? And by that, of course, they mean camp. For years I rejected camp. And I suspect my hostility stems from all the frustrations I felt growing up, watching portrayals of gay men on screen with whom I didn't identify. Gay men were always presented as minces and queens, the butt of everyone's jokes. And it made me uncomfortable. Sure, I'm gay, I'd think, but I'm not that kind of gay. I'd go to indie rock concerts, roll my eyes at lisping queers, wear flannel.
Ladies and gentlemen, whether you like it or not...
Ow! Hedwig! Don't you know me, Kansas City? I'm the new Berlin Wall. Try and turn me down.
How did some slip of a girly boy become the internationally ignored song stylist barely standing before you?
Then, in 2001, I watched a film on DVD, John Cameron Mitchell's Hedwig and the Angry Inch. It blew my little brain apart. based on Stephen Trask's stage musical of the same name. It's about an East German genderqueer singer who survives a botched sex change operation, is fucked over by horrible men, only to rise above it. Watching Hedwig, both the film and the Broadway musical many years later, made me realise that campness, queerness, and femininity are powerful things. And that hatred of camp, that fear of it, is a form of sexism and homophobia. You see it all the time, types of masculinity being policed by gays themselves. No femmes is as common a refrain on gay dating and hookup apps in the West as no Asians and no fats. And as an Asian guy myself, I now see all those boundaries of acceptability for what they are, bigotry and bullshit. For the last few weeks, the Australian queer community has been mourning Tyron Unsworth, a teenager, just 13, who committed suicide after relentless bullying about his sexuality. From grade 5, Tyron was taunted with jeers. Gay boy. Faggot. Fairy. This is in 2016. All of this because of bullies thinking they're tough heroes, Tyron's mother wrote on Facebook. Now I don't have my son. Never will I ever get to see my beautiful boy alive. Why does this still happen? If we agree that there's nothing wrong with being gay, what a film like Hedwig shows me is that we must affirm that there's nothing wrong with being queer either. And if you're a mincing homosexual, you should mince so hard your legs become hamburger meat. And when people think they've got you sussed out, it's not your responsibility to remind them of all the other things that make you a three-dimensional human being. It's their responsibility to look closer.
The Australian writer Benjamin Law. He's the author of two books, The Family Law, published in 2010, and Geisha, Adventures in the Queer East, from 2012. His first book was adapted into a television series for the SBS television network earlier this year. Now, if you've ever seen a classic Australian television comedy, you'll likely be familiar with Magda Szubanski. She's synonymous with so many legendary characters, it can be hard to keep track. From the second best friend on Kath and Kim, Sharon Strzelecki, to the hopelessly out-of-touch television host Pixie Ann Wheatley, Magda is a legend of the Australian screen. But even if you've never seen Kath and Kim or the 90s sketch comedy series Fast Forward, you've probably seen Magda at work. She starred as the farmer's wife in the much-loved film about a talking pig, Babe, and she was the voice of Miss Viola in Happy Feet. And she might have even convinced you to never again try a hot Chico roll in the 2010 musical Brand New Day. Magda was in London recently and she popped into Midori House for a chat about her time on the Australian screen and getting to know her inner self.
There haven't been a lot of really successful Australian comedies, unfortunately.
It's true, it's true.
But I sort of was part of what's referred to as, you know, the golden days of comedy in Australia, which was the late 80s and the 90s, and was in some of the sort of what have become, for want of a better word, iconic Australian shows that were also like huge rating, like Fast Forward was the top rating show of its time, and then Kath and Kim is the most successful comedy in Australian television history. So, and Kath and Kim really, through Fast Forward, but then Big Girls Blouse and Kath and Kim, we really had a huge impact on the vernacular. I mean, the way that people say nice, different, unusual, you know, unusable. There's so many catchphrases that are sort of woven into it. So I can't go anywhere in the world if there are Australians there without someone going, nice.
I was trying to hold it back, but now that you give me permission.
Don't.
Quite recently, we were just having a bit of a debate in the media about the concept of women being allowed to be funny, most notably with the recent Ghostbusters film. And it feels as though internationally, the world is only just adjusting adjusting to the concept of a funny woman, but here you were with your colleagues back in the 90s and the 80s.
You know, Christopher Hitchens said it, and my mother is Scottish-Irish. She and her sisters are hilarious. You know, she is the funny one in the family. So I grew up, demonstrably, women were funny. It's just, it's a lie to say that women are not funny. You know, they also say lesbians are not funny. Like, lesbians are hilarious. You know, it's just that men are so ignorant of female culture and lesbian culture, not surprisingly, but you know, you have to understand the references. It's like British people, I think, understood Kath and Kim because they'd had Neighbours. So they got the cultural references. If you don't know what the cultural references are, you're not going to get the humour. I mean, humour is notoriously difficult to translate. And there is a cultural chasm between men and women. Women participate in male culture because we have to. Patriarchy is the dominant paradigm, sounding like a 90s cultural theorist there, but true.
And then you decided to come clean about your sexuality and...
Yeah, I wouldn't say come clean because that implies I had not come clean before, but I'm very of the view that people come out in the right time for them. I think as a community we're really changing our attitude towards that in that there's more understanding of that you don't know what pressures people are under and you don't know what sort of journey they're going through and there's not a one-size-fits-all. And despite being a public performer, I'm a very shy person. And, you know, once you come out, you know, you're facing things like people thinking about your sex life, people being disgusted with you, all sorts of prurient interests. You know, I have never wanted nor welcomed that. You know, I really, that's a completely separate issue from the politics of sexuality. There's that opening up of your personal life that it is the thin edge of the wedge and you're letting the tabloids in. And I think it's a really natural response to kind of not want to do that. But that said, you know, I've always been a very political person in my analysis of the world. And that was hard for me, weighing up those two things. Plus, I've struggled with anxiety and depression. And, you know, I was sort of like, oh, do I really want to open myself up to that? I mean, I've seen famous friends who've had terrible treatment from media about various things. And, you know, once you step into that, you can't always step back out of it. So it's not an easy thing to take on necessarily. And I thought long and hard and I prepared and it went incredibly well for me. I was very fortunate. It doesn't for everyone, but it's absolutely been life transforming and I'm so glad I did it. But I kind of resist this idea of like, it's like a kind of gay version of, you know, the born again Christian idea that you come out and everything's fine. It's not necessarily for everyone. It depends on, they've done studies and how well it goes for you depends on how well it's received. So I don't say to people, oh yeah, come out. I would never force anyone. Come out if you're safe, primarily. Make sure you're safe. Make sure you've got a very strong support network. You know, there's a lot of considerations about this and this sort of blind idea that coming out is going to solve all your problems. Of course it doesn't. That said, it was empowering in a way that I would never, ever have realised and it changed me in a way that I could never have anticipated. And you go from this back-footed sort of position to a position of feeling like you're really standing on your own two feet. And through that action of doing something brave, I felt brave. Because you do, I think quite wrongly, you feel ashamed that you're not being your full self. I'm a really open person, but you do carry a shame with that. I think that's part of what, you know, societal homophobia does to us. I don't think you should blame the victims for that. But to release that has been an extraordinary feeling. And now I just feel so free, you know. But I mean, I get all sorts of stuff. The other thing they love doing is getting, because I did Jenny Craig, they love getting pictures of me and my wet clingy bathers being fat on Bondi Beach. And like, once that's happened, you're like, oh, dude, you know, bring it. What else can you do?
You
know?
Oh, my God.
I'm free. Good day.
Coke, please.
Nothing else. Take your fancy. We got hot sausage rolls, hot roast beef rolls, and hot Chico rolls.
Woo, it's hot in here. Can I have a hot Chico roll, please? Oh.
A wonderfully bizarre clip of Magda Szybanski in the 2010 Australian musical Brand New Day, capping off my interview. Magda's new memoir, Reckoning, is out now. The past few years have been quite positive for LGBT characters on the screen, from Brokeback Mountain and Weekend to Blue is the Warmest Colour. One film that holds particular significance, however, is Milk from 2008, which stars Sean Penn as Harvey Milk, the legendary gay rights activist and politician. Stuart Milk is the nephew of Harvey Milk and a co-founder of his uncle's advocacy foundation. Here he explains why LGBT characters are very important, but certainly no replacement for real-life experience.
Folks that are portrayed on television or portrayed in movies that are LGBT is important. I know one element of UK LGBT History Month will focus in on characters throughout UK history of openly gay characters, and that's one of the elements that those 15 hubs will carry forward. But there's nothing that replaces personal knowledge of LGBT people. So I don't want to in any way say that in pop culture, having out LGBT people is enough. Because, you know, I'm going to go back to this U.S. Supreme Court again. Justice Ginsburg, who's one of our most ardent supporters and liberal justices on the Supreme Court, she was after the marriage equality ruling. She said that 10 years ago she wouldn't have voted for it, but that she knows LGBT people in her life, and she said, and most of the justices do as well. And that's why we voted for marriage equality. And I think that that can't be minimized enough. And so one of the great things about LGBT History Month that schools out and UK LGBT History Month committee have created is an opportunity also for people to tell their stories, to reinforce the power of that. I mean, we have Harvey Milk style young heroes that they're not facing bullets, but they're going into a kitchen table conversation with their parents. That is still tremendously difficult. I don't care how many Ellens we have, how many Elton Johns, it's still difficult to tell your parents that you're going to be different than 97 or 94% of the population and that you are a gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender person. And it's difficult in a corporate boardroom to hear a homophobic joke and say, do you know you're talking about me? These are the everyday heroes that are changing hearts and minds. And that's, to me, the critical point. Two years ago, the largest democracy in the world, most populous democracy, India, take 1/6 of the world's population backwards when they recriminalized LGBT people, not the T. But so think about that. 1/6 of the world's, 1 out of every 6 LGBT people in the world went backwards, became recriminalized, went backwards 2 years ago. And that needs to be out there because some people feel like, you know, well, maybe it doesn't happen. I sometimes hear people say, including some celebrities, I've heard them say, it will be great when one day I don't even have to mention that I'm lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. That's antithetical to Thomas Jefferson's message. It's antithetical to my uncle's message. We have to be visible. And we have to make sure that those young people who are on the verge of having that all-important and difficult kitchen table conversation have somebody that they know in their life personally that they've connected with that's out and visible and unmasked.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you. To preserve your democracy. Brothers and sisters, you must come out. Come out to your parents. Come out to your friends, if indeed they are your...
A clip from the 2008 film Milk, starring Sean Penn and James Franco. The Schools Out program mentioned by Stuart is available to all schools everywhere in the world, even if you're in Australia. Still to come on The Cinema Show, we'll look at a new documentary chronicling the history of one of the first gay and black nightclubs in Los Angeles. And we'll hear from the Oscar-winning screenwriter, Graham Moore. This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned.
Do you like bad movies? No, neither do we. But don't worry, we've discovered a cure for bad films. It's called MUBI.
Sometimes Wells' films aren't very nourishing. They're very exciting. Citizen Kane, I think, absolutely wins the competition for the film that has made more people want to become a filmmaker than any other.
Every day, MUBI adds a new must-see film to its carefully curated selection. No junk-filled mess or endless scrolling. Just an assembly of the best movies from all over the world waiting to be devoured. To sample a whole month of movies for free, just head over to Mubi.com/monocle. That's Mubi/monocle. Hurry now, the film's about to start.
This is the Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. We explored the classic night spot, the Coconut Grove, on the Cinema Show on our Los Angeles special a couple of weeks ago. But after that style of nightclub faded away, a new breed sprung up in its place. One such classic haunt was Catch One, which, from its opening in 1973, became known as America's first black disco and a rare place of free expression for LGBTI people. The new documentary, Jules Catch One, explores the legacy of the club with the woman who started it all, Jule Tice Williams. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Jule and the film's director, C. Fitz.
The beginning happened in 1973, and it was located right across the street from a grocery store that I'd been a checker at like 4 or 5 years prior to that. The idea came to do a club. It was doing economic hard times to recession, so I went out looking for a club, and I thought about the one that was right across the street. You know, the rest, as they say, is history. I ended up at that club.
Yeah, absolutely. And was it very hard? Did you suffer quite a lot of prejudice at the time?
One of the reasons that I knew about the club was because I had customers that were coming into the market that were complaining because they wouldn't allow blacks to come in, or at least they wouldn't make them comfortable. They couldn't just straight out forbid them, but they wouldn't make them comfortable if they wanted to come in and have a drink after work or whatever. So they were complaining, and I had this fleeting thought that one day I would own the place and everybody would be able to come. It was 4 years later and doing a lot of other things before I ended up coming back and doing exactly what my spirit had spoken to me about that.
And Fitz, of course, you did amazing research. You spoke to a lot of very interesting characters, you know, that were part of the history of Catch One as well.
The research, boy, it covered a lot. It covered a lot because we had to talk to the patrons, we had to talk to our patients, but there were also a lot of celebrities that not only performed there, but danced there. Like Sharon Stone went there to dance. That's incredible. So did Madonna. And then we've got amazing performers like Thea Austin and Bonnie Pointer and Thelma Houston and Sylvester. Folks that dance there, perform there. And researching all of this was more than I imagined. And also there was a lot of stuff that just wasn't documented. And that's why we need documentaries like this.
And Gio, I just want to talk about the importance of such space. I mean, especially what happened this year in Orlando as well, in a gay club. It is a very important space for the gay community, and of course at that time as well for the black community in LA as well. If you tell us more about the privilege of such a space, you know, like on the dance floor and everything.
Yeah, it was a privilege for me too, because I did some more coming out. 1970s. The beginning of the gay evolution in Los Angeles was like 1969, so we were opened up.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco chatting to C. Fitz and Jule Tice Williams about the new documentary, Jules Catch One. And finally today, if you watched the Oscars on television back in 2015, you likely remember the wonderfully moving acceptance speech by Graham Moore as he was handed the award for Best Adapted Screenplay for The Imitation Game by none other than Oprah Winfrey. It was an amazing moment, not just for its raw emotional honesty, but also the inspirational tone it struck. We spoke to Graham from his home in the United States.
Thank you so much to the Academy and to Oprah for this. I need to shower my love and kisses on everyone who's a part of our imitation game. Alan Turing never got to stand on a stage like this and look out at all of these disconcertingly attractive faces. And I do. And that's the most unfair thing I think I've ever heard. So in this brief time here, what I want to use it to do is to say this. When I was 16 years old, I tried to kill myself because I felt weird and I felt different and I felt like I did not belong. And now I'm standing here. And so I would like for this moment to be for that kid out there who feels like she's weird or she's different or she doesn't fit in anywhere. Yes, you do. I promise you do. You do. Stay weird, stay different, and then when it's your turn and you are standing on the stage, please pass the same message to the next person who comes along. Thank you so much.
I knew since I think was pretty young that if I ever had a public venue such as I apparently did at the Academy Awards, that's what I wanted to use it for. I didn't write anything out. I didn't write anything down. I didn't tell anyone I was going to do it. But I think I just sort of knew somewhere that, you know, I'm a writer, which means how many times am I ever going to get to be on television in front of tens or hundreds of millions of people? That was sort of my only 45 seconds on television in my life, most likely. So I thought I should use it for something really meaningful.
While his acceptance speech at the Oscars garnered him plenty of attention, Graham was eager to get back to work on his novel, The Last Days of Night. He had been working on the story during his breaks on the set of The Imitation Game, and, at least initially, he had little interest in seeing it become a film. The book follows the invention of the electric light bulb and the sensation people felt upon witnessing artificial light for the first time.
You know, reading about the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, when people were seeing electric lights for the first time kind of around the world, it was, when you read their diaries of the experience, they describe seeing electric light for the first time as if they were seeing a new color. I mean, people had really never seen anything like this at all. The effect was shocking, literally and figuratively. And so I was so excited by sort of diving into this period of rapid technological change that produced this rapid cultural change. I mean, there's all these societal effects of electric light as well. Crime rates start dropping precipitously in urban areas because it's really hard to rob someone at night if it's really bright out. And likewise, you know, factories can start running 24 hours a day in shifts because of the lights. You have all these domestic labor starts working out differently because people can stay up later at night. People's working days are not tied to sunshine in the same way they had been. So I was so excited by this period of kind of exploring this period of technological, rapid technological growth and the cultural and sociological societal effects it was having. And then, of course, the question that I started getting excited about was, okay, so who was responsible for it? You know, there were these three figures, these three great scientists of the late 19th century, Thomas Edison, George Westinghouse, and Nikola Tesla. And they each thought they were the one who invented the light bulb. And that was the question that I first started digging into with the book. How is it that three different people each thought that they were the ones to make this happen?
The Oscar-winning screenwriter Graham Moore. His new book, The Last Days of Night, is out now, published by Scribner. And that's it for today. The Cinema Show is officially 1 year old this week, thanks to all our listeners and subscribers. Next year, we'll be launching a special spin-off series featuring original essays from some of the world's most fascinating writers. Stay tuned for that. Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio. The Cinema Show returns next week. Until then, in the words of Graham Moore, stay weird, stay different. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.